Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we have a little bit different format for this week. I think first we should start with what are we drinking, which is, of course, the usual format.
That's right. It is only 9 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. And so despite my last strong showing of champagne cocktail today, I'm drinking a hearty cup of fresh coffee.
Excellent.
I am drinking a light, crisp vino verde, which is sort of like drinking juice in the morning, more or less. Just has alcohol in it.
I've definitely been doing some vino verde. It's a nice happy hour drink when you're doing happy hour Zooms that won't leave you totally hammered at the end of it. And I am drinking just regular coffee, but I am eating blueberry scones that I made this morning with lemon curd, courtesy of Deb Braybird and Herb Carmen. So I am really living my best life at the moment. These scones turned out way better than my first batch. And, you know, I still have some work to do, I think, on the whole butter situation. But we're making progress. So quarantine baking remains a thing.
I think, as a rule, more butter is usually better. But I guess in baking, that's not necessarily always the case.
Oh, no, that's basically the case. And you've got to, like, shave it, you know, or grate it, essentially, because you want these really small pieces. Anyway, it's a little tedious. Mm-hmm. But it is delicious. So I'm very happy about that onto this morning. Lauren, your new home office looks fabulous.
It is. It's very pleasant. It's also very quiet. That's also quite nice. So I'm not anywhere nearby the rest of my extremely loud, not so small, but loud family.
Okay, so as we were planning this episode, I kept hearing David Diggs in my head saying, "What I miss." And so this is sort of a, you know, "What did I miss" episode of, you know, I know at least for me, like, my news consumption habits have changed. I'm not commuting, so I'm not listening to the radio in the morning. I'm honestly not really getting showered or ready in the morning, so I'm not listening to my morning podcast. So my kind of, like, day-to-day consumption of what's going on in the world has been a little different than it had been before this quarantine period. But we have a handful of topics, some familiar, some a little new, that we'd like to dive into. Lauren, do you want to kick us off with our first bit?
Sure. So you probably saw some somewhat mocking tweets over the past couple of weeks about former Navy SEALs, former Special Forces, former U.S. military members who were involved in a very, very badly done coup. Like, I have to hesitate to even call it a coup in Venezuela. The stories on this are amazing because you're first like, okay, I can see how this got started. And then you're like, wait, they thought they were going to have 800 guys and they tried to do this with 60. So anyway, highly recommend following up on some of the amazing investigatory journalism that has taken place. But the bottom line, as far as we can tell right now, is that there is this former soldier, former Army Special Forces guy who started a security company that somehow met and got involved with the Venezuelan opposition, persuaded them that he wanted to be part of doing an overthrow mission of the current sort of illegitimate, mostly illegitimate Venezuelan government. That's a whole other topic to the side. Swears up and down, and it has some evidentiary proof that he had Juan Guaido and other opposition members' formal approval to embark on this mission, had training of former Venezuelan soldiers in Colombia, had basically, like, had persuaded some people that he was sort of pseudo-representing the United States government, mostly by dint of the fact that he was an American and had been in the presence of Trump before while he was doing security at a rally at one point in time. So that's the foundational story. And then it kicks off when, instead of, you know, doing a secret coup, he just sort of announced that this boat had launched on its way to take over a port with only like 60 dudes, most of whom were throwing up over the side, so that everybody knew they were coming. Even if they hadn't already known they were coming, he told the world that they were coming.
And there's some evidence that the Venezuelans, I mean, of course, the Maduro government in Venezuela, and we've talked a little bit about these dynamics before, but the Maduro government in Venezuela is now claiming that they had known for quite some time they had this group completely infiltrated. There is some reason to believe that they'd known at least for a couple of months that this plot was sort of in the mix. My favorite bit of this is I was reading up over the weekend, and both Bellingcat and the AP have some very good kind of chronologies of these things, is that the main Venezuelan interlocutor, a former major general named Kleber Alcala, is currently in prison in the United States on federal drug charges.
Yeah.
Because basically what he's really good at besides being a former major general is running cocaine. And so, you know, it's sort of just like it's like a bad season of Archer somehow. It's like, you know, a 2-episode stint that you'd be like, it wasn't really my favorite. It was a little out there. But it does tie into a number of very common themes in both the ongoing saga in Venezuela, our policy toward Venezuela, and our history in the region more generally. And so while it both has these incredible late, you know, empire kind of overtones, you know, to it, it's very much part and parcel of how many people in the region see U.S. foreign policy. And in particular, there's always sort of some weird scheme that may or may not be, you know, sanctioned by the highest corridors of power, you know, in Washington.
No, I just felt like, I mean, I really encourage people to actually read the reporting, because some of the descriptions where they're like, these guys were like living in totally barren conditions with no running water, and they were like training with like sawed off broomsticks. This is because there was a plan for maybe a pointy sword fight. It's not totally clear.
The AP story had this amazing line where someone described this meeting at the JW Marriott in Bogota as a Star Wars summit of anti-Maduro goofballs. And I thought that was perfect.
I personally really liked how they studied the Bay of Pigs as a possible example to follow, even though much of the time as I was reading this, and this tells you how deep I have sunk into the DC blob, all I could think was, but guys, like, there's a whole literature out there about how to do coups. Or how not to do coups. And you appear to be like following all the was of what not to do. So you kind of want to just like contact these guys and like, look, we have some friends, they're academics, like they're not going to advise you, but you should read their stuff before you get started on these things.
No, I don't want them to read any of this stuff. I want
That's
them
true.
To, you know, puke over the side of small boats. All right. Anything else we have to say on Venezuela? This is ongoing. Essentially, there were two Americans who I guess are now prisoners in Venezuela. The leader of this company, Jordan Gaudreau, the company is called Silvercorp, is not in custody in any way. And it's not clear that if he's broken the law in the United States in any meaningful sense. So I guess that's sort of ongoing. But it is just this very, it's like, oh, meanwhile, right? There was like maybe like a sort of like really botched like coup attempt that maybe yeah. Keith Schiller was involved in, who could say.
So a way to connect this to our next conversation on Iran is, what does it mean for when overt U.S. policy, or somewhere between overt and tacit U.S. policy, is regime change of, you know, encouraging, we want this current regime to go away. We're not going to tell you how exactly, but we want it to go away, which is effectively where our policy was in Venezuela, particularly when John Bolton was in office. Nobody really seems to care about Latin America in this moment in this administration, which is very unfortunate. Well, moving on to Iran, similar issue. As we continue, we brought you guys up to speed a little bit on the tactics being used to continue this to extend the arms embargo, which is going to expire in the fall, as well as to pursue snapback sanctions, bringing back all UN multilateral sanctions on Iran because they're in violation, according to the United States, of the JCPOA, which, again, is rich because we are not ourselves a participant in the JCPOA. So further in this saga, would you guys explain the latest maneuverings? Or maybe the latest response, I guess, is the more accurate way to say it.
Well, this was what we talked about last time was kind of hints and rumors. People were sort of saying, can you believe the gall of the Americans to say that they're going to use JCPOA to enforce snapback sanctions, even though we called it the worst deal in the history of the world or whatever. But this week, Brian Hook, who's our special representative for Iran affairs or whatever within the State Department, had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal laying out exactly this, why Iran must remain subject to an arms embargo, which I honestly think a lot of people would sort of agree with. I mean, all things equal, we'd prefer their people not be selling weapons to Iran. That said, the arms embargo formally, as enforced by the United Nations, expires this fall. And so what Brian Hook is now formally proposing is that we pursue, that the United States will pursue the continuation of that through the snapback sanctions. And so instead of going through the United Nations process on the arms control specifically, we're going to say, look, everybody already signed up to snapback. Now you all are under the obligation to do this. And as Lauren notes, that's a little rich.
And I don't think it's not being received like super well. And some of the quotes I think are very telling. So like even the European Commission, which in fairness isn't per se have a seat at the table, but is a good indicator where the European heads are at, noted that the quote, U.S. has not participated in any meetings or activities with the framework since the deal was announced, since it's announced it was ending participation in May 2018. And like, I think they were pretty clear that the U.S. was not in a position to push really anything. And China has been even more explicit, saying that like it has no intention of jumping on board any plans to extend UN arms embargo on Iran. So,
well, and China is probably the party that has the most interest in potentially having arms sales to Iran in some form or fashion. But you know, to extend the arms embargo either through the UN Security Council or even to get real action within JCPOA, there is some, you do need some sort of consensus. And in particular, China and Russia have said, who have vetoes on the Security Council, obviously, that they are not interested in extending the arms embargo. That may provide some cover to the Europeans who are really in a rock in a hard place. I mean, I just can't imagine. Can you imagine just like how exasperated they must be? I mean, it's literally, you've got to be freaking kidding me situation in those capitals after.
I have an analogy that I don't know if you guys will get, but I'm going to pursue it anyway for just a second. That, okay. So this is like Babysitter's Club. Did you guys read Babysitter's Club when you were kids? Okay. This is like,
my sister did.
So this is like in the Babysitter's Club. Logan and Marianne dated for a while. Logan was like a sort of a pseudo member of the Babysitter's Club. This is like Logan and Marianne broke up at one point. Logan dumped Marianne, or it might have been mutual, but effectively Logan dumped Marianne. But this is like Logan coming back to the next week to the or maybe like a year later to Babysitter's Club meetings and being like, hey guys, I got some new rules for us all to pursue in how we do our Babysitter's Club stuff. And everyone else is like, but no, you were here because you're dating Marianne. Like, this is the only reason you're a part of this organization is you're dating Marianne. We don't want you to be a part of this anymore. But Logan's like, no. Here's how we're going to do this, because we agreed I was a part of the Babysitter's Club the whole time. Anyway, I'll stop there.
I honestly don't get, I mean, there are some interesting questions about international law to the extent that any of us believe that that exists. And maybe it exists as, you know, a set of agreements amongst sovereign states, in which case, what does it mean to leave such an agreement? And are there still binding actions, you know, for the other parties in the agreement? I mean, there is some sort of interesting questions to me about whether the U.S. left first or Iran left first, and really what is the assessment? Because JCPOA, as we've said, you know, it's not a treaty. It has some support through the United Nations through certain other sanctions and sanctions mechanisms, but is mostly a set of agreements amongst the, you know, involved parties. And so it doesn't have kind of a supranational enforcement mechanism or even, you know, clear peace. So obviously dollar denominated economies are a very important part of this, right, Radha?
Yeah. And I was just going to say, part of the problem here is the U.S. The U.S. has no credibility really in any dimension of this, which is it doesn't have any credibility in the actual participation in the agreement. It doesn't have any credibility in any kind of international leadership or consistent positioning. And it doesn't really have any sort of leadership in this response to international crises and informal mechanisms sort of in this post-COVID world. And sort of to pivot us slightly to the world of U.S. and China, in case you missed it, we're going to start a new trade war. And it's China's fault that...
Why?
Well, we're cross. Some of it is not totally crazy. Like, it does appear that Beijing destroyed some samples of the novel coronavirus in some labs, maybe to reduce the risk of further spread, maybe to destroy evidence that they were involved in some way. Who can say? It's Beijing. But most notably, the president's sort of chief economic advisor, Peter Navarro, was on the shows just this morning being very loud and assertive in stating that China is in fact responsible for destroying the global economy and that the U.S. is considering ending all trade with China. which comes on the heels of a ruling regarding chip makers in the U.S. and whether they're allowed to sell things to or sort of partner with Huawei, which again isn't actually a terrible decision in and of itself, but it's hard for it to get nested in a credible either national security or trade
It's just
lens.
So inconsistent, right? I mean, yeah, it's just, exactly. It's, yeah.
And there's this huge supply chain dependency that the U.S. and everyone in the world has on, turns out, pharmaceutical manufacturing, which even pharmaceuticals that come out of other parts of Asia depend on sort of derivative chemicals and other manufacturing needs to come from China, of course. And so in a world where basically China is super defensive and probably does have some things to hide and hasn't been a great credible actor in this, and the U.S. has at the best framing is abdicated international leadership and probably more accurately sort of undermined a lot of the true efforts to get to the bottom of what happened. It's hard to imagine anything good happening either on the China economic front or on the U.S. leadership vis-a-vis other countries and economic stability front. And so trade war 2020.
Yay. But you know what I like about the trade war 2020 situation is that for all that, like, I feel like most of us kind of agree with the mantra that foreign policy does not matter in elections. Now we've actually hit this weird cycle where people are saying that China, who is tougher on China, is the weird battleground of the 2020 election. Like, maybe that's just like the niche China circles that I see on Twitter. But like, I've seen multiple like Reuters and others reporting about how like, no, really, who is the toughest on China between Biden and Trump? That's going to be the battleground, guys. And I just feel like, well, we want you to care. We don't know that the average voter is really going to care.
Yeah, I don't know. It gets us back to sort of mercantilism in some bizarre sort of way. And, you know, the supply chains that Radha references, you know, I've thought about in some other contexts. And for the most part, as far as I understand, Radha, please correct me, the issue is not so much that China has access, like has geographically has superior access to key materials, or there's a few minerals, but other than that, it's just that they have, you know, like their labor force is huge. And so their labor costs are low.
Right.
And so they provide inputs to a lot of other, you know, more refined supply chains at a much lower cost. And so it is the case that you could reconstitute those things elsewhere, but that would take time and it would also be quite expensive.
Yep.
And supply chains actually, you know, as you sort of listen to some of these stories, you know, Kai Rizdal's done a lot of this on Marketplace and elsewhere. You know, if people don't just go to like some anonymous market and like sell, it's not like the Chicago Board of Trade where you're selling pork belly or orange juice futures, right? But you're, in fact, many people have specific actual buyers. And so there's these personal connections that matter in supply chains as you figure out actually who you want to buy for, and you build relationships and trust and sort of supporting processes and timelines and whatnot. And so it's not just the case that you can like go to Amazon and do just in time, you know, whatever for some key, you know, material, whether it's a reagent for, you know, testing or critical, you know, sort of metals or other parts, you know, potentially for, you know, machinery or whatnot. So, I mean, Radha, did you know that supply chains are fascinating?
So interesting. And also the fact that China can centrally coordinate and plan things actually makes their ability to sort of pivot and respond to global needs much better. So generally, it would be hard and costly to dramatically change our supply chain structure. And doing so in the middle of, I don't know, possibly a global recession or depression seems tricky. It's tricky.
So we had what? We have two more, what did I miss, type topics. Shall we talk about inspectors general or whether the Defense Department makes vaccines?
They're sort of related.
Okay.
I'll do Inspector Generals really quick. I think folks have probably seen, this is Sunday, they have seen in the news, we've had the latest in the sort of Friday night massacres of Inspector General or Acting Inspector General being relieved. This latest one was at the State Department. Most of the Inspector Generals who've been are active in this administration or were active were not Trump administration appointees. They've been acting since the Obama administration, or they just remained since the Obama administration. Not all of them. So like the intelligence community one is an exception to that. What is consistent about them is that the Trump administration likes to fire them on Friday after like 6 p.m. in this,
which is called take out the trash time.
Yeah, I was like, is it fascinating or anyway? Continue. Yeah,
it's a commonality. This most recent one at the State Department, allegedly, according to Congressman Engel and Senator Menendez, one thing he was pursuing was an investigation of whether or not Secretary Pompeo was using State Department assets for a personal gain. Which, to be clear, like, this is actually a big issue for almost all political appointees at a senior level, is figuring out the line of where they allowed to use staff for things that support their ability to do the job versus things that sort of enhance their lifestyle. And a lot of people struggle with that. And I think it's particularly interesting comparison to how the U.S. military works, where they get a lot of staff support to support their own lifestyle, cooks, lots of other things. So anyway, we will find out more about that over the coming weeks. He was removed. But as a reminder, Glenn Fine, who was the Department of Defense Inspector General, who was also going to oversee the entire COVID relief fund, vaccine development, he was overseeing all of that as part of the network of IGs. He was also asked to step down. The intelligence community IG was asked to step down. And now I'm totally forgetting the other one who was asked to step
down. HHS, I think.
Health and Human Services.
HHS was also asked to step down after she noted a pretty significant gaps in our preparedness for COVID-19 in some ways. So as I've said many times before, presidents can ask anyone they want to serve in these administrations. I think the American public has a right to expect qualified candidates also that they not be relieved from political purposes. It's very obvious, given that he said the intelligence community was IG was relieved for political purposes, that's probably a running theme here, too. Worth following to see how this continues to play out.
Lauren, are inspectors general typically civil servants within those departments or organizations, or are they formally nominated political appointees?
It really varies in terms of their background. They are appointed by the president. Some of them may come from an internal career, having worked their way through DOD. Some of them may be not acting. Some of them may come from the outside. Some of the more recent ones, there's the one who's now acting at State Department is a former Foreign Service officer who's then an aide to Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. And then some of the other ones that have come in are former or current U.S. attorneys that have come in and acted. So it's usually the ones that we're seeing being put in place are not totally crazy people off the street. They're just being asked to come in after their predecessor was removed for more political purposes.
And I think that it's, for those of us who are kind of process people or institutionalists, this is the whistleblower channel. I mean, So it's for big things, but it's for smaller things as well. I mean, fraud, waste, and abuse writ large, other kinds of complaints,
toxic workplaces.
Exactly.
That's a big part of how, not big, but one of the significant things that you see the State Department focus on is how well their embassies are running, given that they're largely or almost exclusively led by presidential appointees, and how is that appointment process impacting the state of those embassies overseas. But you also see waste, fraud, and abuse, as you talked about, criminal allegations, sexual harassment. IGs do a whole lot of things. And they are, as I said on Twitter, if you care very little about the function of government, that's fine. I get it. But you should care about inspectors general because they're the ones making sure that all the shit's working and not being completely wasteful and not wildly rampant illegal activity going on. And you're effectively doing what the law and policy say. If we don't have them, then one of our big checks on power is not there. And certainly Congress is not doing a lot to oversee these days.
And I was, in fact, just going to say that I kind of see this, the sort of devolution of the IGs in the same vein as the sort of politicization of oversight, which is there's a role for obviously politics in all of these policy and government functions. But there is this key oversight function that both Congress and these IGs and a number of processes set up in the executive branch and the judicial and the legislative branch are set up to really check against. And basically over the last, decade, those have been eroded almost completely, such that even, a number of the congressional oversight committees that had been historically much less partisan on the intel side, on the defense side, have become increasingly partisan. These inspectors generals, which had been largely, not super sexy jobs, right? Investigating detailed but pretty minutia of waste, fraud, and abuse, inefficient workplace complaints, whistleblowers on bad boss management, abuse of power, not big New York Times front page stuff, are getting slowly kind of removed over time, not that slowly anymore even. And I think in the end, you end up with basically no insider oversight on a government, which just kind of reinforces people's concern and probably the likelihood that the government isn't operating efficiently or effectively.
I think it also then pushes people to leak to get issues addressed. And sometimes that is appropriate. And sometimes, given well-functioning processes with inspectors general and other, you know, ombudsmen, is totally inappropriate. And for those of us who, you know, have sort of wrestled with this over the years, you know, if you're really going to politicize or effectively neuter the internal review process, I think you're begging for people, you know, more of this information to be dealt with in the press, which is even further politicized and sort of gets everyone's, you know, hackles up and into camps and doesn't let the institution address its issues, you know, internally. That's not going to be great, frankly, either, for those of us who think that there are some things that should remain classified or should be dealt with, you know, within proper channels. The proper channels are being eroded quite significantly.
So to transition quickly to our last topic that I'll just quickly update you guys on, speaking of potentially wasteful institutions that need lots of oversight, so this week, it happened a couple of weeks ago, but it was sort of like driven home this week that the degree to which the Department of Defense is going to be heavily involved in the development, distribution, maintenance, and so forth of of a COVID vaccine. Mark Esper was sort of heavily quoted and pointed at as he kind of did a press conference. We talked about winning against the vaccine, having the Department of Defense be, you know, putting all of their resources, their scientists, their distribution power, their logistics behind the development and ultimate distribution of the vaccine. And, you know, I go back and forth on this, like, yeah, this probably makes sense in terms of, like, if you do want to develop a vaccine and get it out quickly to the American people in a useful way, DoD has a lot of assets for that. However, the reason that no one else has a lot of assets for that is because we've heavily invested into other parts of government or into other kinds of public-private partnerships that might be useful in that vein. It was also just sort of notable the degree to which we continue to treat COVID. When we take it seriously, we talk about it in warlike terms and militaristic terms, and how that is possibly impacting all of our mindsets about this crisis, about the people who are working on it, about the kind of resources we could dedicate to it, and how we treat it as a strategy overall. Sort of like we are very much in like the vaccine focus as opposed to the preventive monitoring preparedness focus, which is a nice analogy to how we treat most foreign policy crises.
You know, friend of the show, Laura C, has commented on the kind of public health infrastructure in Africa, in West Africa in particular, and how much better suited that is because it's sort of community based and it's really interpersonal as opposed to being technology driven or, you know, late stage treatment driven, and how that approach is much more suitable to what we actually need to be doing right now than treatments, ventilators, I mean, and vaccines, all of which are important, but you actually need means by which to do that. And that's a lot. That's a big community health and public health sort of apparatus. And as you know, Lauren, we have not spent our money in that space.
But more importantly, guys, we wanted to talk about books.
We do.
Books make us happy.
They do. So we have a couple of categories, and I think so we'll sort of, you know, Radha, you introduced this idea. Do you want to sort of lay out the categories and explain what we want to kind of do here?
So in our chats in thinking about, you know, what pop culture levity we could bring to the discussion, it occurred to me and to all of us that we read books for a lot of and things in general for a lot of different purposes. And it might be helpful to talk through a little bit about the kinds of things we're reading these days to kind of meet our intellectual and emotional needs in a bunch of different ways. And so the idea that we had was to think about what books are we reading to learn and understand the world around us? What books are we reading to learn and understand ourselves and sort of help us cope with the current conditions? And then what books are we reading when we don't want to learn anything and we just want to escape what is the hellhole of a global pandemic and being stuck at home, in my case, with your family all the time and two very adorable but very noisy children? And sort of how are we approaching that and what are we reading and thinking about? And so, yeah.
So when Radha, you know, posted this, you know, she said, it's, you know, books to learn, books to cope, books to escape. And I have to say that I was totally unable to distinguish between the latter two categories, which is probably something that I should take up with my therapist. This explanation is a little bit more, you know, fulsome, but, you know, coping and escaping seemed identical to me at the time. Should we start with books to learn and go from there? Who has a book? I mean, so these are not necessarily books that I'm reading right now, although I guess a couple of them are. But these are books that I have either enjoyed in the past or think some of our listeners would enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things that I, as you guys know, I don't read a lot of nonfiction, although in this moment I have found myself more inclined to. And I'm trying to piece together like why that's the case. Is it because I kind of already know how it turns out? Is it because it's like not especially stressful? Is it, you know, just somehow easier to access? But one of the books that I'm reading is The Plantagenets, which is this history of the Plantagenet monarchs, partially because with some other friends, we are watching the Hollow Crown series on Amazon, which
I know
is
I really
like,
need to get into this.
Henry the Fourth, Henry the Fifth, and then the you know onward you know pieces, and starts with Richard the Second. So there was some confusion over the history on John and the Richards and whatnot, and so we went back. I said that I needed to go back and read a bit of that. So that's I don't know why it seems escapist, but I do love reading about Eleanor of Aquitaine kind of all the time. So that's a nice little bit if you're into you know English history.
So is that books to learn?
That's to learn. I mean, these are all escaping in some way, right? These are basically all just about like not being in my current head. There are a couple of others that I have not read yet, but that I seemed interesting. One is a new one called The Year 1000, which is sort of about the nature of trade and kind of human interaction in the year 1000. And the other is called Funny Weather, Art in an Emergency. And it was actually written well before this current moment, but is about kind of the role of the arts in difficult periods of human history, which seemed relevant.
Okay, I will mention a book. I'll re-mention a book that I mentioned last time that I'm enjoying. And then also a category of books that is from a list, like it's almost 13 years old now that I'll mention again as well. So the first one, last time we had an episode, I mentioned that I was getting into The Fifth Risk by Michael Lewis. And this is a super nerdy book. It is the focus of it is about the transition from the Obama to Trump administration and how the Trump transition and his appointment process and other things led to a lot of hollowing out of government in some ways. And he focuses on, I would categorize it as functions of government that are sort of inarguable. The people are like, all right, we need government to do those things like nuclear security, monitoring poisons in our water, and things that seem as though like, all right, I need that function to be done. Makes sense that government does it. And I assume he does this on purpose in a way to ensure that, you know, people are not automatically repelled by the use of government functions in this way. But there's a nice kind of link to a piece in the Washington Post. I think it came out today by Dan Balls that is on the same concept of hollowing out of government. Michael Lewis focuses on it very much from a Trump to Obama, Obama to Trump perspective. But the increasing number of political appointees and the way that they are filled by people who are not necessarily qualified is one really interesting facet. But a more interesting facet to me is the way that continuing resolutions and budget caps and the lack of willingness to invest in technology in some ways in our government is just really holding back government from doing what it was supposed to do, even in the areas that we can all agree we want government to do that. There was one statistic in the Post piece about how I think it's something like 60 to 70% of all technology investment is just maintaining old legacy systems as opposed to buying new ones in any way. Very similar issue to our Defense Department, which is why you go to the Defense Department and they're also using Internet Explorer from like 10 years ago. It's a security issue, but it's also a monetary issue as well. So that's one big one. But then I'll also mention, I'll put in show notes, there's an amazing thread on Metafilter that I love where people ask, what is a nonfiction book that explains your field in a way that you love to people who are not in your field. So, and it's great because it's, you know, mathematicians and biologists and actresses and sex workers and all of these people who describe, here's the book you should read if you want to understand what it's like to be in my field. And it's meant to be approachable to people from the outside. So I'll share that as well.
I like all Michael Lewis books for the most part. So I second. I mean, The Undoing Project is also, it's just incredibly good. And I found it surprisingly moving when I read it a few years ago. I think we've talked about that here.
So I actually have a sort of similar vein of Lauren's, which is I'll start with my books to learn, which I will confess that I swear that I don't normally read textbooks just like for fun. I know it sounds a lot like I do whenever I give book recommendations, but Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson, who are these economists who I have the great pleasure of knowing, but also who totally have, I have major Twitter crushes on. They have come up with a series of textbooks, but I actually really enjoy the first one, which is Principles of Microeconomics. And they're basically intended to be intro economics textbooks, but like for economics to be useful and interesting. So like how every day, just how many donuts should I eat? Like how you think about everyday decisions in an economic concept and why these like weird assumptions and economic models exist and sort of what they're useful for, but also what they're not. And the idea they had in making these textbooks was like economics can be actually really interesting and useful. But when we present it to people, and often the only exposure people get to it is this really completely ridiculously stylized and largely useless like economic models you get in your like principles college 101 class. So the books are like pretty readable. They have great explanations. I don't know if I would sit down and read them cover to cover if I were you, but if you're thinking, hey, there's a lot of sort of economic talk going on these days, and I'd like to better understand what was going on, I actually think they're a very accessible way to, pun intended, course correct from your college learning to get some economic foundations in there. In terms of books to cope, I have two. I think I've probably mentioned both of them before, but they are both fictional-ish books. And one is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, which is written by a therapist about a sort of fictionalized version of her decision to seek therapy when she was like, huh, I have this relationship that's not great. And I have this job that's kind of okay. And I feel like I should be happier than I am. And it's actually a really great way to sort of work through like what therapy is and isn't, what you can get from having therapy in your life and the different roles it plays. And similarly, the book How Not to Hate Your Husband, which I also highly recommend, isn't really fiction, but does have a lot of sort of humorous anecdotes and stylized stories and figuring out, especially in a world where folks are trapped in their home with their husband and sometimes or partner and sometimes small children, can be a useful set of strategies. But I'm mostly speeding through this to talk about this series of books that I love that I've just started rereading by a woman called Marion Keyes, who's a Irish author who writes like sort of chick lit. And I say it's sort of chick lit because it's Irish. So basically every story includes some kind of terrible tragedy that should make you feel like the book is depressing. Like your husband dies or you have a serious illness or you've lost your job and been kicked out of your apartment or whatever, right? Like some like really major thing that's happening, but instead is a hilarious, humorous romp through a large Irish family as their various, it's a family with five daughters and each of the books like kind of goes through a period of time in the daughters' lives that goes through kind of with some humor and some total escapism where everything works out in the end. This Irish family and their travails and successes. And I highly recommend it as a way to escape from your everyday world where everything is slightly funny and always works out in the end.
Wait, okay. So were those your coping and escape books?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cause I have separate books
Me
for
too.
Coping and escape. Yeah. All right. So my coping book is that I've read, but like, I'm kind of working my way back through again right now, that I think I again have mentioned before on this podcast is Daring to Lead by Brené Brown, which I believe I've also said that the reason I read it is because Kristen Bell recommended it, because why wouldn't you listen to Kristen Bell? But I would say the main theme of it that feels really resonant right now is to be a good leader, you need to be vulnerable. And vulnerable not only with yourself, but also with your team in some ways. And that doesn't mean like going in and like sobbing in their office at all times, but to acknowledge the way that fear and feelings and direct honesty needs to be a part of your dynamic with the team of people who work with you, but also under you and above you. And it seems particularly resonant to me at this moment where I have all these great stories from people about how their organizations are coping together in a flexible and emotionally resonant way in a really tough time. And then I hear these terrible stories about how people are having to, like, you know, log on to their computers minute by second, minute by minute to make sure that they're doing precisely the right amount of work, or are being expected to work excruciatingly longer hours at a point in time where they are scared, they are worried about their families, their kids need them, or anything else like that. So I recommend it as a way to be thoughtful about how to approach this current moment and in coping with working and leading and being part of a team, whether it be your work team or other teams, in this really kind of terrifying moment.
So I don't have a good coping book that's like an actual, I want to say self-help, but sort of purposefully, you know, relevant, you know, in that vein. Mine is fiction, and it's called The Elegance of the Hedgehog. And it's it's beautifully written. It kind of sits in the same file drawer in my head as Gentleman in Moscow, even though it's totally different. It's a very slim novel. It's set in France and basically focuses on this one kind of elderly woman in a apartment building in Paris. And it's just delightful. And it's sort of like all the things that you should delight in your life with. I mean, it's not fizzy. I mean, it's sort of, you know, serious in a certain way. But it is, I don't know, it is sort of soothing. If you do want fizzy, another French type novel is called Petronille. And it is about these two friends, and they kind of fall in and out with each other. And there's a lot of champagne being consumed. But again, sort of focuses on just sort of the nature of human interaction and human friendship. And those are kind of, that's what I go to good fiction for, is to help explore some of those, you know, connections and those feelings. I will say I did talk to my therapist this week, and like one of the things she was really good at helping me with is putting in context. She was like, oh yeah, like 2 weeks ago, all of our patients hit the wall. Like across all of the people in this practice, everyone, like it was, and not just in the like, oh, I'm kind of sadder now, but like serious question, you know, some folks were dealing with, you know, a variety of different issues. And so it is good to, you know, whether you're talking to a therapist or to other people, you know, to, especially if you're living on your own as I am, which is a different set of challenges than living with small children, is to say, oh, you're not just left alone with your thoughts all day long.
Yeah.
These things are actually, you are part of a shared experience still. That's not just you, you know, against the world with your plants. So, you know, that is a nice thing. Okay.
Let's do, what was our last one? Escape. The other comment I was going to make on your point, Aaron, like in terms of like people are having these feelings in waves. My therapist similarly talked about this, how there was a point, I don't know the time period, where a lot of people were having a sort of British stiff upper lip, mm-hmm. sort of blitz like feeling, like all in this together. And then you realize that this fucking sucks. And you, everything that you thought was going to, like, you're going to be able to overcome, and those minor inconveniences that you were going to like plow through, actually, they really suck. And not only do they really suck, they're so much worse than you thought they would be.
Well,
so,
and you can't, you know, to the extent that I think for the first month of this, people were sort of holding their breath, you know, it's like, well, we'll power through and then it will be fixed. And mm-hmm. it's not been fixed. And we've talked about, you know, some of the policy, you know, pieces, you know, of that, but it was also never going to be quote unquote fixed. And so this is not just a like minor perturbation or like a short term, you know, everybody hold your breath and then we'll survive. But it's like, you had to find an entire new way of breathing, and we have, mm-hmm. and no one can tell you what to do or how to stay safe, or if you have a job, or if your kids get to go back to school. So,
right.
Tra-la-la, you know, let me know how that, you know, finds you.
And you don't know when it's going to happen. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what, I drew on a variety of both recent and long favorite pieces for escapes. Lauren, what did you have on your escape list?
So I have so many escape books. Like, folks know that I'm a rereader, and I have different books that I can just go and pick up again. But the ones that I think are most escapist to me as a concept are, how do you say the word, where it's books where you're writing letters or in a diary, epistolary?
Oh.
Epistolary?
Maybe. Yeah, sure.
Let's say epistolary. This is, again, a word that I learned from reading, so I don't actually know how to say it. But it's books that are people writing letters back and forth to one another, or the author is writing into their diary in some way. And I think the reason I love these is because people who are writing letters to someone or who are writing in their diary, that is just an escape from something in any form. They are portraying themselves and their situation in a way that is pleasant to them or is coping to them in some form. Or they are reaching out to someone who is not a part of their lives in order to have a connection that it is not possible for them to have in person at that moment. So most of mine are like not super serious. Like I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith is a fabulous book about people growing up literally in a decrepit castle in the UK. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society is a post-World War II just total gem of a book. Aiding Charing Cross Road is another one set in the UK. All these are set in the UK. Actually, no, except for one. Take it back. Codename Verity, really depressing. Amazing book. Really depressing. Mm-hmm. Be careful with that one. And then the last one is Daddy Long Legs, which is a book by Mark Twain's niece about a woman who is sponsored to go to college and sends letters to her benefactor who never responds to her except with like highly personalized gifts or outings or other things like that. And she begins to like oddly fall in love with him, even though she's never met him. So there's some creepy elements to it too, but you're also, it's a very charming book about early 1900s women's college life in New England as well. So all of those are good escapist literature.
And I will say, like, I find like escapism, rereading books to be a really effective approach to escapism. So I, like Lauren, like to reread, though I just have like a core set of books that I read over and over again. It never expands, hasn't in years. And I was just, in fact, rereading Anna Karenina, which is on this list, and thinking, wow, all the books I reread are so depressing. But like, there's something vaguely comforting in the like escapism into someone else's depression. So anyway,
it's like listening to Automatic for the People. You know, I mean, it's just sort of the shared shared sadness. Lauren, in that vein, there's an amazing spy novel that I think Laura Rosen recommended to me called The Mirnik Dossier, which is set as a series of telegrams all from different people. And so it's unreliable narrator and you're trying to piece together. It's actually very similar to the Venezuela coup situation. So it's a very different sort of thing.
So you can both learn and escape. It's like a twofer.
So I, you know, love spy novels and mysteries, although I don't usually turn to them for, you know, coping or soothing or even sometimes a little bit of escapism if they have a really strong sense of place. And there are a few mystery series, you know, outside of kind of like British mysteries that do well on that front. My escape books tend to be, you know, I read the sequel to The Rook, which I think is called Stiletto, which was good escapism. And it's not quite as good as the first one, as you told me, Lauren. I also just finished a book called The Incrementalists, which is too hard to summarize if you're kind of interested in like very, I wouldn't even call it science fiction, but it's immersive, right? And it sort of like sweeps you away and you could spend a weekend reading it. Two other books that are kind of longtime favorites. One is The Mists of Avalon, which I read as like a 15-year-old and have definitely reread at different points. I haven't reread it in years, but I sometimes will pick it up and read, you know, one part of it.
I remember vividly exactly where that was in my very tiny hometown library. Mm-hmm. And like I had gotten into King Arthur and the librarian was like, you might like this. And like, I don't know, it looks big. And then as it turned out, I did.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I read then all of the Marion Zimmer Bradley, like Arthur stuff, all the Lady of the Lake stuff, all of the everything. My mother did too. It was hilarious. So Mists of Avalon is this sort of feminist, pagan-ish retelling of the Arthurian story. And it is rich. It is at times dense. There's a whole section of the plot that I never liked and I learned how to skip over it when I did my rereading.
That's like the best part of rereading is you get like exactly. The book, the exact version of the book you want.
And so the other pit here, we haven't talked much about David Mitchell, but Cloud Atlas, I think, is an incredible escape. And it's really five or six different stories. And it has a very unusual structure, but one that basically works once you kind of give into it. And a related book is his A Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which is also, I think, fairly immersive. It's a little more weird and more complex, but it really creates, there's a lot of world building and it's a historical sort of setting. That one's set in Japan. So those are both two books I like pretty much everything by David Mitchell, even the Bone Clocks. But those are sort of just very rich other places to go and spend a lot of time in with, you know, some incredible language. For you two ladies, I feel obligated to say my mother just gave 5 stars on Goodreads to The Huntress, which is written by the same author as The Alice Network.
Oh, so. Okay. Oh, well, I do enjoy The Alice Network. And I feel that we'd be remiss in any book discussion to, especially one that references escaping to another place, without reminding folks that there are an excellent set of Bronte and Austen novels that folks could reread and escape to. And actually, next on my and in my solid,
I haven't read them in 40 years, and I'm not starting now, Radha. You can't make
well,
me.
Well, I mean, you might try it. You have some time on your hands. And if you didn't want to go all the way to sort of Victorian England, you could also read some of the Edith Wharton novels, which I think also provide some society intrigue and the like. And my favorite of that batch is The Age of Innocence. So there you have it.
I mean, in that vein, I am currently reading the 3rd Crazy Rich Asians book, which I never got
See?
To previously.
So it's
not Vanity Fair,
and
but it's obviously
Austen's
in that
language,
ilk.
Like, is just truly amazing. Even if you don't want the plot, the words are, she has a way.
My next read is going to be Empire City by Matt Gallagher, which, if I'm looking at it and understanding it correctly, it's an alternate history that has a lot of Civ Mill themes to it. So all of our Civ Mill nerds, if you feel you can cope with your field while reading fiction, this looks like a great way to do it. I actually have myself been having a hard time with the idea of dressing this in fiction because it's just like, it's too much. There's just too much Civ Mill. But I'm excited about picking up Matt's next book.
Outstanding. Well, I hope that this gives, we'll try to pull these links together, these ideas together, and put them in our show notes, and hope it provides some points of departure for people both to read and to talk about books, which is honestly one of our favorite things. In addition to actually reading them, it's talking about them with other people. So put together a Zoom call, sit on a picnic blanket 6 feet apart from someone, and talk about some good things that you've been reading. And we'll see everybody again in a couple of weeks. Bye.